Well, greetings to everyone. It's good to be here again. As those of you who have been here previously are aware, this is basically the third in a series. And for those of you who have not been here before, we've been talking about the battle of the sexes throughout history, and it's taken three sermons to get there. And if you'll recall, we started with the notion that if you look at Genesis 3, there, because of the disobedience of Adam and Eve, that there were curses imposed on man and on women. And from that time until this, there has strangely been a certain degree of animosity between men and women, and in many cases women have throughout history suffered at the hand of overbearing men and men who subjected them. We went through the concept that both the Hebrew and the Greek world that was in play at the time when Paul lived, that both of those cultures basically disregarded women. Thought them as, I think it was Aristotle said, that woman is nothing more than a malformed or a deformed man. And that they subjugated women, and women throughout history have been regarded as cattle and treated as livestock. A little more freedom in the Hebrew world, but largely in the Greek world, women were wives, and I'll segregated to wives, were literally segregated and had no social contact, unsupervised at all. Even at the time of Jesus Christ, he created a revolution that was a forerunner of the New Testament church, whereby women were even talked to. Some of the women that are presented in the Gospels would have created a scandal, and yet they are presented as a revolutionary new development in male-female relationships within the Church of God. It did not escape the scribes and the Pharisees, and they had many ill views toward Jesus Christ because of that. But Jesus Christ taught his disciples, and he taught Paul in the wilderness for that 3.5 years, and he taught Paul the appropriate approach that men should have with women in the Church of God, in the New Testament church. And he inspired Paul to write, and many of those writings have been subjected to spin over the course of history as the apostate church developed and as the influence of the Gnostic invasion into the church pushed to drive those thought processes back to the Greek ideal. Because many of the church fathers during subsequent centuries after Jesus Christ pushed back toward that concept that women are not worthy. Whereas Jesus Christ and the Apostle Paul were basically saying that we are brothers and sisters equal in Christ. Now, when we consider the writings of Paul, well, anytime we see a historical event, a biblical historical event, and using case in point, what Dorian was just talking about, we can get a wrong concept if we don't look at the cultural and historic realities. If we look at things through the lens of our own society, if we look at women as being nothing more than a deformed man, you know, in our period of time, there is a battle of the sexes still going on. Listen to any woman CEO of a major corporation, and you hear stories about women should have equal pay, and it's almost like they hyper-focus on those issues. Women should have equal pay, by the way, for equal work performed. I don't want you to mistake my point here. My point is there is still a battle of the sexes. There is still not equality, and women still want equality, and men don't want to give it to them. And if women had equality, that still wouldn't be enough, because they would like to be on top for a while, I'm sure. Okay. When we consider the writings of Paul, we filter them through the lens of our own eyes. And we filter them according to the knowledge of how it is that we live. And yet, the life and time of the Apostle Paul was a very important time in the development of the church that we're a part of now. Paul was talking to the church at Ephesus. Paul was talking to the church in Corinth, in Philippi, in Galatia, in Thessalonica, and in Rome. And their cultural practices were vastly different from ours. And they were at a time when, even at the time of Paul, at the time of Jude, at the time of Timothy, we were seeing the Gnostic idea making inroads into the church at that time. The Gnostics were wholly Greek in their outlook. Plus, they also held that a normal male-female relationships were wrong. And so today, I'd like to continue along that field of study. So, with the invasion of the Gnostics into the New Testament church, as it expanded and grew over the next several centuries, all the way up into the time of the Reformation, into the time of the Enlightenment, there was a gradual erosion back to disregard for women in the apostate church, all the way to being, you know, I've always thought when you read the scriptures, it's almost like you have to consider that there are tares in the wheat field, if you look at Jesus' parable of the tares. But it's almost gotten to the point where there is wheat in the tare field, to where the prevailing outlook that came to be was one, and there was only a glimmer of light here and there. There was only a sprout of wheat here and there in all of the wrong that has been spouted over the centuries. Well, let's consider how Hebrew women worshipped. Hebrew women worshipped. They were allowed to go to the synagogue. At the synagogue in Capernaum, Jesus would have been very familiar with the synagogue at Capernaum. They had a room above the sanctuary. It was accessed by a set of stairs on the outside from the court of women. And there was a curtain between this gallery. It was a gallery, it's like going to the opera and setting up high in the gallery above. Sort of looking down and observing the services. And the women could go there. They could listen to the service. But they were not allowed to say anything. They were to be totally silent. Women also were not even considered. There was a type of quorum established by the scribes and the Pharisees to determine whether you could even have a synagogue meeting or not. You had to have a certain number of people there, and it only considered men. Women were not considered. They were not worthy to be counted as human beings for that purpose. And so women's were out of sight and silent because, let's remember, the Jewish population at the time of Paul was in conflict. You had the scribes and the Pharisees. You had the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Sadducees themselves taking a more Hellenistic approach, and many of those in the Greek cultures would see a woman in church as symbolic of cultic prostitution. And so it was not proper or appropriate for a woman to be seen in services among men. And so the Hebrew world largely saw women in church as and openly participating in church services as being improper. As we discussed before, a Greek wife, on the other hand, because you see this is a clash in the church in Corinth, in the church in Ephesus, in all of these churches in the Mediterranean, they were a combination of both Greeks, Gentiles, and Hebrews or Jews, and it was a clash of cultures. You know, when you find customs about wearing a covering on the head, men did not. Women were to wear a covering on their head. Even that issue was a divisive issue, because what was good for one was considered repugnant to the other. And so Paul had to manage a joining of two disparate cultures into one expression of worship to the one true God. And those things that we have from our earliest days, that were taught to us, that were made an integral part of our being, are very hard to put aside. Even if you're given proof, it's hard to believe. It's hard to have to make a change in direction in our closely held cultural beliefs. The Greek women, wives, I'll separate it to wives, were basically isolated by their husbands. And there were kept in almost total seclusion except for household staff. And they basically did not go out. And they were there for one purpose, and that was to produce legitimate offspring. Many of the sexual practices of the Greeks were driven by the thoughts and the ideas of the Greek philosophers. Homosexuality was rampant, and the use of prostitution was accepted as a normal course of life among Greek men. And Paul had to deal with those issues and those populations when he had the church in Corinth, the church in Ephesus. All of these locations would have had similar natures to them. There was a group of women who were dedicated to the worship of Aphrodite, the Greek goddess Aphrodite. They were called the Hetairai. And they were practitioners of temple prostitution in the temple of Aphrodite. They were dedicated to her service, and the service was performing orgiastic sexual worship. And men went there to worship. Now, we may find that somewhat amusing at times, but they didn't find it amusing. They found it natural and normal as a part of worship. And their status in the Greek society was greater than the status of a married woman. They were urbane. They were educated. They were instructed in the social arts. They were taught by previous priestesses when they were young to conduct themselves properly according to the worship system of Aphrodite. They were able to discuss philosophy, politics, all these things that men wanted to talk about. Can't talk to my wife about that. She's stupid. She doesn't know anything about this. And so these women were highly sought after for social contact, the Hetairai. And it's interesting, when both Peter and Paul are talking to the women in the New Testament church, 1 Peter 3 verse 3. We will look at that, and then we'll look at 1 Timothy 2 verse 8 and 9. First Peter 3:3, and here Peter's talking about, and if you just look at it on the surface, it's talking about being concerned about beauty issues, right? Do not let your beauty be that outward adorning of the arranging of hair, the wearing of gold, or putting on fine apparel. It was the practice of the Greek Hetairai to wear their hair in the latest styles, to wear gold ornaments, and to wear the finest of clothing. And the purpose for that was to attract men to the worship of Aphrodite. Now, let's talk about a woman who has been shut up in the house, not just for the past few years, but essentially all her life. All her life. Her father may have been very wealthy, and she might have had costly clothing, but she never had to go out in public. And suddenly, here we are, we have women in the New Testament church who went out in social setting, maybe for the first time in her life. And finally, they were saying, well, you know, let's back up a minute here. Go to the grocery store, and you're waiting in the checkout line to have your groceries checked. And look at the magazines there at the checkout line. Glamour magazine. Sexy, sexy. How to make yourself sexy. How to make yourself look great. Women's Day magazine. Sexy. I mean, the checkout line caters to what society wants. And sex sells. It sells hamburgers. It sells cars. It sells trucks. You know, Ford hasn't missed the sex revolution and how it sells. You know, you got a good-looking blonde or a good-looking redhead riding that new Ford truck. Well, you got to go out and buy yourself a new Ford truck. And it was no different there. The Greek and the Hebrew women in the New Testament church saw the appeal of some of these things, and it began to bleed over a little bit. And so, start coming to church, and you know, you're concerned about the gold, you're concerned about the hairstyle, you're concerned about the costly array. And Peter said, "But let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God." And then slipping on over to 1 Timothy, the second chapter. Here, Timothy, we've got, you know, Peter back in Jerusalem, or wherever Peter was at this point in time. And here, Paul writing to Timothy, and he says in verse 9, "In like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel." The hetairai were dressing for a reason, the way they were dressing. To attract. Well, everybody wants to be attractive. And the Hebrew and the Jewish women of the New Testament church see this attractiveness and they begin to emulate this. Modest apparel. And the hetairai were not dressing modestly. With propriety and moderation, not with braided hair, not with gold or pearls, and the pearl was considered the premier gem of the day. You know, you can go to a mine in the desert or someplace like that and get a diamond. But you got to go to the bottom of the ocean to get a pearl. And a pearl was extra special. Pearls or costly clothing, but Paul's admonishing Timothy with his ministry, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Okay. And so we see that this clash of cultures was having a certain effect on the church that that Paul had to counter. With the advent and example of Jesus, women became an integral part of the worship in the church of God. Let's look at how they became, where they were not permitted to worship before. All of a sudden, they are permitted to worship. Acts, the first chapter. Acts 1 and verse 14. All these continued with one accord in prayer and supplication with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with His brothers. Women and men, both involved in worship and prayer together. Acts 8, just over a few pages. And verse 12. But when they believed Philip, as he preached the things concerning the kingdom of God and the name of Jesus Christ, both men and women were baptized. Revolutionary. Women were not considered a legitimate part of worship previously. And I'm going to have to move on, so I'll just go through some of these. And Acts 16, verse 11 through 15, a lady by the name of Lydia mentions nothing about her husband. Lydia, a seller of purple, was converted, and her household, I think had she been married at this point in time, it would have included her husband. But this was Lydia and her household. And then Acts 17. Acts 17, verse 4. And some of them were persuaded, and a great multitude of the devout Greeks, and not a few of the leading women, joined Paul and Silas. And in verse 11, these were more far-minded than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness and searched the Scriptures daily to find out whether these things were so. Therefore, many of them believed, and also not a few of the Greeks, prominent women as well as men. My whole purpose here is to show that women and men were fully and equally introduced into the worship of God in the New Testament church. Acts 17:34 mentions Dionysium and Damaris. Philippians 4:2-3, Euodia and Syntyche. Romans 16:3-4. Let's turn there. Romans 16:3. Greet Priscilla and Aquila, my fellow workers in Christ, who risk their own necks for my life, to whom not only I give thanks, but all the churches of the Gentiles. Both Priscilla and Aquila. Romans 16, verse back up two verses. To verse 1, I commend to you Phoebe, our sister, who is a servant of the church in Cenchrea, that you may receive her in the Lord in a manner worthy of the saints, and assist her in whatever business she has need of you, for indeed she has been a helper of many and of myself also. And it goes on and on. It talks about in Romans 16, verse 7, just a few verses down. Greet Andronicus and Junia, my kinsmen and my fellow prisoner. Apparently they were, while Paul was a prisoner in Rome, they were also a prisoner, or it may be some association with their helping him, that they were they considered themselves prisoners while he was a prisoner, I don't know which. Who are of note among the apostles, who also were in Christ before me. So apparently they had come from Jerusalem. They had come from the Holy Land, and they were actually converted before Paul was converted, and they were influential in the church. Women were not excluded from open and active worship of God. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians 11. We're right there at the doorway to 1 Corinthians. And verse 7. For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. Okay. And the point of this, and the Stoic Greeks, the Hebrews and the Stoic Greeks, thought that it was Eve's fault that Adam sinned in the Garden of Eden. The Stoic, the Gnostic Stoic heresy presented that thought and idea, and it was carried down in the apostate church for centuries until a man by the name of Thomas Aquinas finally wrote a treatise that basically said that all sex was wrong, married or otherwise, and it should not be practiced, and women were evil, and they should be kept in their place. Said, but these folks, the Greeks, the Stoic Greeks, and the Hebrews, thought that Eve had led Adam away from God, was a distraction to Adam's holiness. And here, in verse 7 of 1 Corinthians 11, Paul is countering that argument. He's saying here that man is the glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. It's the same type of relationship that God has with man, and now man has with woman. And God is reminding the church that the Stoic disdain for women is not correct. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 11. Neither is a man independent of woman, nor woman independent of man in the Lord. For as the woman was from the man, even so the man also is through the woman, but all things are from God. He's basically putting man and woman in the worship of God on an equal plane. And then we come to 1 Corinthians. We go on from there. We talk about the unity chapter, verse 12. The love chapter, chapter 12, I mean. The love chapter, chapter 13. And then we come to 1 Corinthians 14. And then all of a sudden, we've been teaching the church that everybody's equal, everybody's worshipful. And then we said in verse 34 of chapter 14, all you women, keep your mouth shut. Let the woman keep silent in the church, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive, as the law also says. Several things here. There are several issues here. But basically, let your women keep silent in the church, and they're not permitted to speak. And that's odd, considering the scriptures that talk about men and women worshiping together. And if that is carried to an extreme, to the extreme, not one of you women could walk in this place and make a peep. Now, we don't believe that. Many times we, you ladies, are involved in the service, but to the extreme, that couldn't be done. And so we need to look a little deeper. What is the context of this passage? You know, I said that you have to look at it through their cultural context, not ours. Verse 26. How is it then, brethren, whenever you come together, each of you has a psalm, has a teaching, has a tongue, has a revelation, has an interpretation. Let's jump down to verse 27. And because Paul's saying, you know, you got all these things, everybody's got something. He says, let all things done for the edification, for edification. And as he goes on down through here, he says, you know, he talks about how to conduct a service. How to conduct, because apparently the Corinthians weren't conducting their service in this way. He's saying that you've got all these things going on. If anyone speaks in a tongue, let there be two or at the most three each in turn, and let one interpret. Apparently, that was not happening. But if there is no interpreter, you know, what's the point? How's that edifying anybody? Keep your mouth shut. Let him keep silent in church, and let him speak to himself and to God. Be quiet, say a silent prayer to God, ask for direction. And then, verse 29, let two or three prophets speak, and let the others judge. Don't everybody all talk at once. But if anything is revealed to another who is sitting around here, you know, you've got the speaker up here speaking, and suddenly that triggers a thought in somebody's mind. Well, what's happening according to what you're reading here? He's jumping up and telling the guy across the hallway here what his thought was. And as I see this picture unfold, I see just total chaos in the church. And Paul's saying, here's what you got to do to prevent that chaos. For you can all prophesy one by one, that all may learn and be encouraged. And the spirits of the prophets are, remember our discussion last time, hupotasso, and is subject to the prophets. It's not some spirit driving you to squeal out. You're in control. You're in control, so you don't have to scream across the hallway here. For God is not the author of confusion, but of peace. Apparently, it was not peaceful in Corinth, as in all the churches of the saints. It said, this is the way we do it. And all of this squealing and carrying on, all of this competition between speakers, all of it, everybody speaking all at once, has to stop because it's creating confusion. And then it says, let your women keep silent. Now, what's this about? Because the subject of this passage is confusion. Well, if we look at it in the same light, the women were causing confusion. He said, let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive, as the law also says. Okay. Since Paul is giving instructions on how to conduct a service. Let's see how it relates here. And first of all, what does he mean by confusion? It's taken from the word akastastasia, the Greek word. And in Luke, the 21st chapter and verse 9, we won't turn there. But this is where Jesus is telling the disciples in the latter days, when you hear of wars and commotions, that is akastastasia. It's confusion all around. And Paul, in 2 Corinthians 6, verse 5, where he's talking about that he's been in stripes, he's been in hunger, he's been in fastings often, it says he's been in akastastasia. He's been in tumults all around. And the world is just in a rage and in chaos because of his preaching. And those are just part of what he had to face. So that's what we're talking about in confusion. So picture the New Testament church here in Corinth and all of the hubbub that's going on. Now let's talk about women speaking. Women are not to speak. And we're looking at that through the lens of a get-together that's in total chaos. And the women are specifically a part of that chaos. He's not talking about women everywhere at all times. He's talking about women in this congregation. And he's telling them they're not permitted to speak. The word used here in the Greek is laleo, L-A-L-E-O. Remember the last time we talked about problems associated with translation? How the Japanese have a term for a taste sensation that we can't even translate into English. That the French have cooking terms that can't be translated into English because we don't have such a word. And that it's impossible to make an exact translation into a vernacular language. Paul wrote in Koine Greek. He didn't write it English. So all the people that say that the King James Version is the only version of the Bible that is acceptable to God, I beg to differ. You'd come much closer learning to speak and understand Koine Greek. But that's a lifetime of activity. Okay, but laleo, the word used for women that keep silent, not permitted to laleo. Okay, what's laleo mean? Well, first of all, let's consider to speak in English. One word, right? There are 30 different Greek words that are in the Bible are translated speak. 30 different words. Which one was he talking about? Well, laleo. And all of those 30 have a different nuance of meaning. How do you mean speak? I'm speaking! I'm speaking. I'm speaking. In Greek, some of those things would come out in the words that you chose to write. Paul chose to use the term laleo. Well, what does laleo mean? When you actually get down to it, it means chit-chat, gossip, catching up on the weekly events. Paul's not talking about speaking in church here. He's talking about chaos and groups of women sitting around chit-chatting with each other. Well,
Now, what did your kids do this week? Johnny, he was riding his bike the other day and ran right into a tree. He broke the bike all up and skinned his forehead. We had to take him to the doctor and the dentist and have one of his two teeth put back in. Okay, now let's look at it in terms of the culture that they're living in. Greek women in particular, but the Hebrew women to one degree or another. The Greek women were, before they came into the New Testament church, were socially starved individual. They had zero meeting skills. How do you conduct yourself in a meeting? They had zero training. They were not Hetairai, so they had zero education, except as one Jewish rabbi said, the only worth of a woman, the only worth of educating a woman is with the distaff, or the spinning wheel. Teach her how to keep the house and keep everything else from her. And another one of the rabbis said that to teach knowledge, to teach the law of God to his daughter was just like teaching her to be a lech, teaching her sexual immorality, because she would destroy men with that knowledge. But Greek women, they had no social contact. Haven't seen Susie or Millie since last week. Have to catch up on that gossip. And so, not one or two of them, but large groups of women. And Paul says, let your women keep silent in church, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive as to the law. What law? What law? Where is there the law that says that women can't chit-chat? Where is the law that says women can't speak in the synagogue? It's not the Ten Commandments. It's not the law of God that Paul is talking about. If you can find that, I'd be happy to know what it is, because I haven't been able to find it. And the only thing that I can come close to, it's not being a reference to the law of God, is some other set of rules, or possibly, according to Ephesians 5 and verse 21, that law of love, that law of willful consideration by a person that we in the church of God are supposed to have, to not cause problems for other people. They were causing problems here. They were causing chaos. And if they were converted, they should not want to do that. But if there is another law, I haven't been able to identify it. Now, when he says, keep silent, that comes from the Greek word sigao, S-I-G-A-O. And sigao, silence, is like you're being put on trial. And the prosecuting attorney says something that the family of the accused don't like. And the judge says, order! Order! There will be order in the court. Oh, I just...
Is that a tax speech?
I just attacked the microphone. There will be order in the court, or there will be order in the church service. He's saying, Be quiet. Be quiet. And it's an insistent, be quiet. And Paul's telling these women who are causing this hubbub to be quiet. If you want to know that that's what it means, I mean, there's a bunch of them. Luke 9:36. Luke 18:39. Luke 19:40. Mark 14:61. Acts 15:12. And back up, Acts 12:17. All are uses of this Greek term, segeo. And so, it's not a command for all women in all times, in all places, to be totally silent. But it has been presented pretty much that way throughout history. It has been used in the spin of the ages to subjugate women in their worship of God. It's interesting when you look at those 30 words in Greek. 5 of them relate to speaking in terms of preaching or proclaiming. 25 of those same terms say are used to simply say or speak in some variety of speaking, like we mentioned here, laleo, or as an indication of speaking in the context of teaching. And there are various nuances being presented. And so when we look at this particular set of scriptures, and where we say that women are not allowed to participate in the worship service in a full way, it goes against what Paul really taught. He taught that women were an important and integral part of the worship of God on an equal level with men. Just like men, they could worship, they could get the full expression and meaning of their worship before God, and that they had to edify. They had to, in their expression, edify. That's what a church service is for. To edify one another, to worship and give honor and respect to God, to gain knowledge, to gain understanding, to gain a meaning of our purpose in life and in our service of one another. You women are important in that regard. And it's not just us guys. We're in this harness together. We're pulling this cart together. And we have one goal, and that is to glorify God and to see my favorite toast in the world. Here's hoping that you all live forever and that I'm there to see it.